Ulysses by James Joyce. The type of work is an experimental novel set in Dublin, Ireland in June of 1904. The principal characters are Leopold Bloom, a canvasser at the local newspaper, Molly Bloom, his wife, Stephen Dedalus, a recent college graduate, and a host of characters, including a number of journalists, an old mariner, a caretaker, priests, and several drunken soldiers. In nearly every imaginable way, James Joyce's novel is like no other, and that's aside from its presenting such anomalies as a 50-page-long running sentence filled with a wife's ruminations, its stream of consciousness flavor, and its innovative, twisting 750-plus-page pseudo-plot. Massive, mythic, and, due to its earthiness, still frequently placed on the adult shelf at the library, Ulysses, first published in 1922, is probably the most ambitious and multidimensional jigsaw puzzle ever assembled out of the English language. But the novel is also something much more pivotal than a juicy literary crossword. It is a work that ushered the world's English language readers and writers into the landscapes of 20th century modernism. In a sense, modernist and postmodernist narrative begins with Joyce. Like T.S. Eliot's influential poem, The Wasteland, Joyce's Ulysses grows out of the early 20th century's drastic redefinition of civilization. While Europeans of the late 19th century had assumed that technological advancements would foster peace, prosperity, and unchecked progress, artists and intellectuals of the new century not only started questioning technology's contribution to humanity on moral and ethical grounds, but they also began to allocate progress to the realm of myth. Thus, writers like Joyce and Eliot focused on the dissolution of the old order. In the tragic wake of World War I, writers discovered both a profound pessimism and a new emphasis on the individual. Freud, of course, had recently posited the existence of the id, a great psychic repository of unconscious impulses and urges that lay deep within the human soul. Thus, armed with this new knowledge, writers and artists like Joyce courted a far less sanguine view of the individual and his experiences than previously romantic-era writers had entertained. In Ulysses, for example, Joyce chooses to depict individual experience as far too fragmentary and multi-textured to be subjected to the constraints of traditional plot. Thus, no story of any real consequence emerges in the novel. In lieu of a traditional narrative, Joyce focuses on the psychology and perceptions of Leopold Bloom, the middle-aged Irish Jew who is Joyce's modern Ulysses. Like Homer's timeless Greek voyager wending his way home to Ithaca after the Trojan War, Bloom lives a life of exile, wandering from adventure to adventure before he returns home to his wife. In contrast to Homer's epic, The Odyssey, in which heroes and gods are truly heroic and godly, Joyce's Ulysses, Bloom, is left trudging the wasteland streets and pubs of lower middle-class Dublin in search of life's meaning, or, at very least, some sort of stepping stone on the pathway leading home. Bloom's errant wanderings are depicted in a single, ordinary Dublin day. And as the routine of this day unfolds, the reader is offered what critic A. Walton Litz calls an encyclopedia of modern life. Litz goes on to say that no matter how we view Ulysses, the ways in which we can approach it are almost endless. We can only conclude that the best reading of the work is the one that yields the greatest number of related perspectives. June 16, 1904 was an ordinary day in the city of Dublin, Ireland. As the early summer sun began to spread Her Majesty over that vast borough, Stephen Dedalus awoke. Dawn had come as usual, much too soon. The life of a young Latin poetry instructor lacked any hint of happy anticipation. Still in mourning for his mother, who had died of pneumonia the year before, vainly pleading with her son to pray for her, Stephen brooded once again over his guilty memories and the appallingly aimless condition of his life. He had no faith, no true friends. What's more, he received no sympathy in his grief from his roommate and only close companion, the vulgar, bullying medical student Buck Mulligan. "Oh, it's only Dedalus whose mother is beastly dead," offered Mulligan. After breakfasting, Stephen and Buck walked to the beach with a new house guest, a Mr. Haynes. Buck Mulligan sang as they went. "I'm the queerest young fella that ever you heard. My mother's a Jew, my father's a bird. With Joseph the joiner I cannot agree, so here's to disciples and Calvary." Later, Stephen made his way to the academy. "Tell me now, what is a peer?" he asked a pupil. But he did not get the expected Latin translation. "A peer, sir? A thing out in the waves," explained the boy helpfully. After spending the entire morning in such tedious, Stephen finally realized what it was that kept him in a sort of paralyzed, hopeless conspiracy with these boys. In them, he saw his own awkward, fearful, impoverished childhood. When at last class was dismissed, the principal of the academy, Mr. Deasy, approached Stephen with a manuscript in his hand. "It's about the foot-and-mouth disease," Deasy explained. He wanted Stephen to use his influence with the local newspaper to have the article published as a public service item. And since Stephen did not feel he was in any position to deny the request, he made his way to the newspaper office. On the other side of town, meanwhile, a middle-aged Jew named Leopold Bloom was just beginning his day with an appetizing breakfast of grilled mutton kidneys, which gave to his palate a fine tang of faintly scented urine. Bloom worked as an ad salesman with a newspaper and carried a dead weight within him. Since the death of their son, Rudy, he had found himself unable to complete the act of sexual intercourse with his wife, Molly. And yet, in the aftermath of Rudy's death, both had often sought comfort in the arms of others. After breakfast, Bloom rode off in the carriage to the funeral of his friend, Patrick Paddy Dignam. As the service commenced, however, he suddenly decided that he detested funerals. "My kneecap is hurting me," he thought as he knelt in prayer. In truth, the whole affair reminded him of little Rudy and of his own father, who had died a suicide. At one point, gazing ahead at the coffin, he wondered, which end is his head? And then, as his mind strayed further and further from here and now, Bloom's brief respite from work was over. Most of Bloom's dismal working day was spent trying to negotiate the terms of advertising space with a tea merchant named Keys. The editor, Miles Crawford, was aghast when he reviewed the final agreement for approval. "Keys was a bloody cheat," he screamed. "He can kiss my Royal Irish ass." Later in the day, Stephen Dedalus arrived at the newspaper office to talk with the staff about the DC article. Crawford, still peeved by the Keys incident, was not in favor of printing a piece dealing with the loathsome and ridiculous subject of foot-and-mouth disease. His readers wouldn't stand for it. They'd read anything but an article about a damn disease. "All balls," howled the editor. "Give them something with a bite in it. Put us all into it, damn it, soul. Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, and Jakes McCarthy." As daylight faded, Stephen, still flushed from drink, met up with Mulligan and some other young scholars at a local tavern. In time, their talk turned to a rousing analysis of Hamlet. "Hamlet was a Jew," one of the young men spat out, scowling. Stephen quickly rebutted this with the proposal that the Prince of Denmark indeed represented the playwright Shakespeare himself. "He wrote the play in the months that followed his father's death," Stephen contended. As for Leopold Bloom, after he left the office, he made his way from the pubs to the seaside. There he happened upon a flirtatious lass named Gertie, who leaned back against a rock, exposing her bare thighs and knickers. She was trembling in every limb from being so far back. He had a full view. And she wasn't ashamed, and he wasn't either, to look in that immodest way, like that, because he couldn't resist the sight of the wondrous revealment half offered. "Oh, sweet little, you don't know how nice you looked," thought Bloom as the girl left. "I begin to like them at that age. Green apples. Grab at all that offer." Bloom staggered back toward the taverns, the pictures in his mind coming one right after another. There was his dearly departed Rudy. Why did his 11-day-old man-child have to die? Then came the lurid vision of his wife in bed with one of his cordial acquaintances. Now his only recourse was to drown his sorrows. He arrived at the pub just in time to catch the last of Stephen's discourse on Hamlet. The conversation then moved on to civic issues. Frequently, Mulligan would turn to stare in the direction of a certain Jewish patron while he voiced his supercilious views. "For the enlightenment of those who are not so intimately acquainted with the minutiae of the municipal abattoir as the morbid-minded Esthier and embryo philosopher, who, for all his overweening bumptiousness in things scientific, can scarcely distinguish an acid from an alkali." After a few more hours of drinking and enduring such bluster, Bloom made his way to Mabbott Street, a nearby lane of enticing ill repute. Stumbling onward, he received sad, ethereal visitations from his dead father, then from an anonymous bearded woman, then from his wife, and finally from his lover. In this state, he came across Stephen again, who in a similar state of despondency was revisited on the spot by the ghost of his dead mother, begging her son once more to pray for her soul. Strolling on together, Bloom and Stephen stopped to cavort with a group of prostitutes until two soldiers happened upon the scene and took exception to Stephen's surly demeanor. In concert, they struck the young scholar and knocked him bleeding to the ground. As the soldiers continued on down the lane, Bloom helped Stephen up, brushed him off, handed him his hat. For refreshment, they then trudged on to a seaside cafe and listened to a scruffy old sea veteran recount his grandiose tales. "I seen a crocodile bit the fluke of an anchor," he boasted. "I seen icebergs plenty, growlers. I was in Stockholm and the Black Sea." Bloom and Stephen listened on in rapturous envy. Never had either of them braved such wonderful explorations. Quite recovered from the beating he had taken, Stephen accompanied Bloom home, where they mulled over the intricacies of music, religion, and life. As the night wore on, Bloom implored his new young friend to stay, to leave his reckless circle and come live with him and his wife. And even though Stephen refused, both men now knew that despite an age difference of 16 years, their lives were irrevocably intertwined. After commanding his wife to arise early and prepare his breakfast, Bloom now finally drifted off to sleep, leaving Molly Bloom lying there awake, thinking of her most recent lover, of her girlhood, of the mysteries of the human body, of the possibility of Stephen Dedalus' refined young writer coming to live with them, and at last of her long-past courtship with Leopold Bloom, of how he kissed me under the Moorish wall, and I thought, well, as well him as another, and then I asked him with my eyes to ask again, yes, and then he asked me, would I, yes, to say yes. And so the woman's thoughts flowed on, pungent, earthy, and homey, while her far-wandering husband snored in the darkness at her side.